It's time for Sports Lit 101. Rich Kimble here. Bruce Pratt with us in studio, and time to talk with the author of a book that we've discussed a couple of times in the last few weeks. Looking forward to hearing from the author of Baseball, The Turbulent Mid-Century Years. Stephen Geacher joins us. Steve, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back. We certainly mind the book Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles, which you edited for about all the ore we could get out of it. And we could spend an awful lot of time on unpacking this book. Just so that listeners know that you are an archival analyst for the Sporting News. You've been associated with the Sporting News on and off for a long time. One of the things that is so remarkable about this book is how meticulously it's researched, but how easily it reads. How long did it take you to do this?
Longer than I'd like to admit, actually. More than 20 years. You know, I thought when I started the project that it might be 4 years in the making, but I guess I forgot that I had a full-time job most of the time and a family to take care of. Well, so it's finally done.
What I found so riveting about the book is you take us, I think, from when baseball stops becoming static sometime later in the dead ball era, up through free agency, up through the changes in baseball. And I would argue that in that period of time, no professional sport was as popular or as enduring and yet so malleable, so changeable. How did that come about?
Well, I think certainly baseball was the national pastime in the middle part of the 20th century. By the 1950s, pro football is on its way to its ascendancy, which of course it still has. Baseball malleable? Well, certainly changeable, yes. Buffeted about by forces beyond the owner's understanding and comprehension? Yeah, I think that's true too.
Mm-hmm. One of the people that wrote about the book said something I thought was really interesting, and this is very true. You examine a lot of baseball, and you find the blind spots, the things that no one else was really researching or talking about, or at least contemporary people don't know. How much fun was that?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. You know, I had the benefit, guys, of a tremendous amount of research being done by all sorts of people, including academics, members of Sabre, people who have contributed to the study of baseball in all sorts of ways. And yet at the same time, I was able to do my own original research and combine the two, doing what academic historians call a synthesis. That was my goal.
Well, and it works because all of the key players that we would think of, I'm not just talking about baseball players, but all the, from Kennesaw Mountain Landis to Branch Rickey to whomever was important, you develop them in a way that we meet them and they don't go away. They just keep coming back into the fabric. And it almost as a leitmotif in fiction. That had to take a tremendous amount of organization.
Yes, it did. Some people use an Excel spreadsheet. I used my basement floor to lay things out and move things around a lot.
When you look at the dead ball era players who played into the more modern era, some of the most legendary figures in baseball, they weren't able to make the kind of living that ball players can make today. Yet they did well for the times. Is there something about their legends that we don't appreciate regarding that?
Well, I think it might be difficult for young people, especially for people who've grown up in the free agency era, to understand what it meant to be hampered by the reserve clause and to be told by the owners, you can ask for whatever you want, but I set your salary, and if you don't like it, you can go do something else. That's a hard lesson to learn.
And it's also amazing to me how long it took baseball to come up with a farm system. I mean, when Branch Rickey starts talking about this, other owners are horrified and other people are horrified. Was it as much because they didn't want to destroy town baseball, or they didn't want anybody else to know where they were finding their players?
Well, it's a combination of things, I think. in part basic conservatism. Let's not change. Let's not fix what's not broken. Of course, it was broken, and Ricky saw that. Before the farm system, of course, all minor league teams were independently owned. They were independent businesses. The Depression, I think, really causes folks to realize that this is not sustainable. And in fact, we had too many minor leagues, too many clubs in too many small towns and cities that just couldn't support a baseball team. And the majors come in and they pay some of the bills, including the player salaries, and allows the minors to rebound and eventually in the late 40s to prosper.
And I think a lot of people don't understand that there were already salary caps in some of those leagues. We think about the salary cap as being a relatively new thing, but even it was the 1930s, I think, there were salary caps for minor league teams.
That's right. Yes, a salary cap for each team in a league. And, of course, the lower the classification, the lower the salary cap. Of course, the smaller the rosters, too. You've got some teams with like 14-player rosters. So the salary bill it's there, but it's not very large.
Well, one of the things that begins to contribute to players making more money, owners making more money, is when they finally figured out that it wasn't a bad idea to put the games on the radio. I found that section, I've read about that before, and how, you know, the Yankees and other teams were really against it, and there were teams that were in favor of it. How much was the changing demographic and the changing location of America, how much did that have to do with it? I mean, you have so much of the Midwest where there was almost no baseball. Radio was the only way it could reach people.
That's right. Well, you know, when you talk about radio and baseball, you have to talk about two things. First of all, minor league games being broadcast on local stations. I think it was true then, as it's true now, that radio stations need programming. You can't broadcast blank air, dead air. You have to have something. And having a baseball game is a way to attract listeners. Club owners were at first concerned that if people could listen to the games on the radio, they wouldn't come out to the ballpark. But of course, the reverse was true. People heard games on the radio and they said to themselves, gee, this sounds interesting. Maybe I should go to the ballpark and check it out myself. It's similar, guys, to what happened when some radio stations, maybe first in New York, I'm not sure about this, began to play records on the radio. And producers, distributors of music said, if people can listen to these songs for free, they won't go to the store and buy the record. But of course, just the opposite was true. We said, I've heard this song on the radio 50 times and I want my own copy.
And the same thing then happens when television arrives. It takes a long time for there to be just one network to do the World Series.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You've got all the networks doing the World Series at the same time. You've got arguments over who's going to hire the broadcasters, where they're going to sit, what they're going to do. What do you think was the stumbling block there? What didn't they get? The opponents of that.
I think television is a much more significant problem for baseball. And I think it's a problem that we haven't yet solved. Look at the blackout situation that's still being talked about and hashed out. There are a couple of problems with television. First of all, people are mesmerized by television, not just televised baseball, but anything on television. Baseball executives were worried that people would stay home from the ballpark and watch the Yankees on television. No, they stay home from the ballpark to watch Milton Berle and Bishop Sheen on television.
Right.
My students used to ask me, when did people buy TVs? And my answer was, as soon as they could afford one.
I was four, I guess, when we got our first TV. And
right.
we weren't the first ones in the neighborhood to have one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, the other problem with television is that the signals, like once stations became knitted together into networks, you could show games that were being played far away. And it has a really adverse effect. TV has a really adverse effect on the minor leagues. It's one thing to listen to a minor league game on the radio, but if you can watch a major league game on television, then maybe you don't go out to the minor league park.
Yeah, Rich and I have, and Kerry have often talked about how when we were younger, the only way you saw out-of-market teams was on the game of the week. You know, yes. So once a week, I might see a National League game. I was always living in Yankee and Red Sox territory most of my life. Now we have interleague play. You can get the major league package. Do you think that's done something to change the way people develop affinities for teams?
That's a good question. Perhaps affinities, or what's the opposite of affinities? I mean, people complain that the Yankees and the Red Sox are on ESPN all the time. You know, maybe hatred, of course, has a different definition within sport than it does in the rest of society. But maybe there are more people who hate the Yankees and Red Sox than previously. I'm not sure.
So one of the really interesting parts of this is when your book, and we're talking with Steve Geacher here on Downtown about baseball, the turbulent mid-century years, is just how dramatically it changes when the reserve clause is gone.
Yes.
I mean, I think there was no more seismic change, probably. Even the breaking of the color barrier may not have had as much effect on baseball as that. Is that a decent observation?
Yeah, well, they're probably one and two. Put them in whatever order you choose. But when players gain free agency and are able to go wherever they can and play basically for whatever salary the owners are willing to offer, that changes the game dramatically. People feared this, of course. They thought the reserve clause was essential to baseball's survival. But look at the game now. It's just amazing.
Game has faded in popularity across certain demographics. As you mentioned, football is the ascendant sport now. Sports like boxing and horse racing, which used to be big, have changed. When you look at the future of baseball, based on how you've seen it change and how incredibly well you've researched it, where do you see it going?
Well, of course, we see the A's going to Las Vegas. I suppose that's a given one way or another. And I suppose we'll add two more major league teams to move from a total of 30 to a total of 32. That probably changes the schedule. It probably changes the postseason system once again. The World Baseball Classic, I think, will grow in importance. Somehow they'll fit it into the schedule. The first two or three of the WBCs maybe didn't get too much attention. But this year, with Ohtani on display, I mean, he just lit up the room. It was, and everybody wanted to see him. So something will happen along those lines. As far as the demographic of people who are attracted to baseball, I've argued, maybe not too seriously, but maybe seriously, that baseball, modern baseball, is an acquired taste, like wine. You and I, you know, grew up baseball fans from the time we were four or five. Maybe that doesn't happen anymore. Maybe you come to baseball at a later age with a little bit more maturity when you suddenly say, you know, this sport that I thought was so slow is really not so slow at all. There's an awful lot going on beneath the surface.
Well, I was very interested because last year I spent quite a bit of time watching University of Maine baseball games live. I had a number of players in my class. And watching the way young people watch baseball was different than I watch it. I mean, they're watching, but they're also checking their phones. They're looking around. They're doing other kinds of things. I'm trying to figure out what the signs are. Is the runner going to go on a 3-1 pitch? You know, the kinds of things we grew up doing because that's what you did when you watched baseball. And so I wonder if the delivery of baseball has a lot to do with the change. You can watch a game on your phone. You can watch a game after it's been played. Whereas if we wanted to watch that game and it started at 1:30, we had to be in front of the television set at 1:30, and at 4 o'clock at the latest when it was over, it was over.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I hope that baseball is able to produce, let's call it an app, so that kids who are looking on their phones can be looking at baseball data that will enhance their knowledge of what's going on the field. I see most of my games, since I live in suburban St. Louis, I see most of my games at Busch Stadium. But earlier this year, the Sabre Convention was in Chicago, and we went to see the White Sox play, the Cardinals, incidentally, an interleague game. But the amount of data on the scoreboard while the game was going on was incredible and impressive and worth taking a look at.
Well, I know that when you watch a game on television and you got the banner below and they're giving you the scores, it'll say somebody's up 6-3, and then you will get every player's stat for the stat line for the game. You know, someone went 0-4, someone's 2-2, someone's struck out so many. Well, one of the last things I wanted to ask you about today is that is there, beyond the people that we think of, is there someone in the history of this game that you think deserves to have had more attention paid to them?
Oh, boy.
That's a loaded question. That's probably unfair the way I ask
it. Yeah, that's, I tried to identify folks, one for each chapter, some famous, some maybe not so famous. I have my favorites. Hank Greenberg's a favorite of mine. And if you read the chapter that features him, you'll understand why. I picked Yogi Berra because he represents the post-World War II ball player. And living in St. Louis, we feel Yogi's presence even to this day. So I'm not sure anybody who's been forgotten. You know, those who study the early years of the game, the origins of the game, way back in the 19th century, will tell you Doc Adams belongs in the Hall of Fame, and I think that's true.
Well, Steve, it's a great book, I really enjoyed reading it, and I especially because I learned so much. It's called Baseball, the Turbulent Mid-Century Years, from the University of Nebraska, one of our favorite presses. I have the advanced copy. Has it dropped?
Yes. Okay. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So people can order this wherever you order books. Go to your local bookstore and order it, and if you can't get to a local bookstore, find an online retailer and get it. Steve, thank you so very much for being with us today, and I hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about my book. I really appreciate it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's Baseball, the Turbulent Mid-Century Years by Steve Geach here. It's a fine book, and are we taking a break now?
Yeah,
or are we wrong?
So we're going to take a little break. We'll wrap up the hour right after this on Downtown.